Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for all of your emails. Keep them coming, please, through the website theunexplained.tv. And it's the same place you can go to if you'd like to make a donation to the show. And if you have made a donation recently, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Your donations are vital for this independent, ongoing work to continue. And, you know, when you get in touch by email to talk to me about the show, you can suggest a guest if you'd like to. You can tell me your own story or just give me some thoughts about the show, how you would like it to develop, the way that I'm doing it, that kind of stuff. Always good to hear from you wherever you are. And as I say, and always say and keep saying, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. When you get in touch through the website, designed by Adam at Creative Hotspot, the website is, and always will be, theunexplained.tv. The topic on this edition of The Unexplained is something that we've approached from different angles before, both on radio shows that I've done and here online. The idea that we may somehow be somewhat descended or maybe totally descended from what you might want to call aliens, creatures from another planet, to sound somewhat Orwellian about the whole thing. On this edition, we're going to have another conversation with Bruce Fenton. Now, the first time we spoke with Bruce Fenton, he was in Australia. Then I believe he moved to Spain. Now he's back in the UK. He's in Wales at the moment. And he's written a book called Hybrid Humans that has what I believe is a unique take on the way that we may have developed and the answer to some of the mysteries of our evolution. Some of the blanks, some of the missing pieces he believes he is able to fill in. He's able to provide information for the pieces of the story that up to now have not added up. Now, you may take whatever view you may take about this, and I welcome your thoughts about this, and I know Bruce Fenton will. But I think he's entitled to a view. He puts a very powerful case in Hybrid Humans, and you're about to hear what that case is. But just think about it for a second, and more people are coming to this thought, that perhaps in some way, some kind of authority, some kind of presence from somewhere that's not here was a part of our past. Whether we escaped from Mars and we now live here and are descended from Martians, whether we're from the Pleiades, or whether some kind of, I don't know, some kind of DNA-like material came from space here, the panspermia theory, I think it's called. You know, there are many, many theories of that kind that would have been laughed out of court 30 years ago, but now serious people give them at least consideration. So Bruce Fenton here, talking about us as possible hybrids. We're going to speak to him from his base in Wales. Thank you very much for all of your feedback. Please keep it coming. Let's get to Bruce Fenton now, and we'll talk about hybrid humans on The Unexplained. Bruce, thank you for coming back to my show.
It's a pleasure to be on here again. Thank you very much.
Now, Bruce, a little confusing. I mean, I must say that in my time, I've made a few moves. There was one year that I worked in and lived in three different places in the UK. I was always in a van moving my stuff. But you were in Australia last time we talked, living there with Daniela. Then you were in Spain, I heard. And now you're in lovely Wales, land of my fathers. What's going on?
That's right, yeah. We're ultimately aiming to be nearer to my family in Gloucestershire, so it's been a bit of a circuitous route. But we also visited your family in Spain of my stepdaughter. She's got extended family there. So there's been some reasons for those moves.
You always struck me, when I spoke to you last time, certainly, as a man who doesn't really switch off from research. So all of these places that you go, are you constantly looking for ideas, for things to look into?
Actually, in Spain, it was quite fortunate timing, because I don't know if you saw in the UK press, there was an announcement that a team had identified what they felt was part of Atlantis down in the south of Spain a few months back. So that wasn't too far from where we were based. So I drove down to some ancient sites that they had identified as being possibly to do with this, you know, sunken civilization, whether we call it Atlantis or something else. So that did tie in. And in Australia, I visited a site called Gosford, which is also linked to this research project. So, yes, funnily enough, it has kind of worked out a bit like that.
Because over the years, people have claimed various places, including one off Florida, may be Atlantis. And I think the general sort of consensus is moving towards the thought that perhaps there are a number of them.
Yes, I think that the safe thing is to say that there was a, you know, a civilization or civilizations that existed during the Younger Dryas that were, you know, and these places were hit with floods. Now, Atlantis is probably such a loaded term that we're wise to stick with lost civilizations, I think.
Yes, I guess so. Okay, let's talk about Hybrid Humans then, which is your most recent book. And let's get a little bit of confusion out the way, and I'm sure you've been asked about this before. The name on the jacket is your partner, Daniela, and yet you are doing the interviews about this. Yes. What's going on?
I did most of the writing on the book. There is contributions from Daniela, but I wanted to separate this title from the previous one, The Forgotten Exodus, that we discussed before. And rather than using a totally made up pen name, my wife kindly offered to let me use her name. So it's more of a move for separating off different topics. But yeah, nearly everything in there is provided by me.
Okay, well, that explains it. I'll get emails, so that that's the answer before they email. Why have you done this research then? I know this research comes out of Australia. That's where you did most of it. Why do this? What was it that sparked this particular trail?
Well, actually, this came out of the work that was done on the last two books. I had, of course, The Forgotten Exodus, The Inter-Africa Theory of Evolution, which really tackles largely the Oceanian region and, you know, what was going on there in prehistory in terms of human evolution. And as listeners will likely know, there's been a lot found recently, you know, all sorts of new hominins have been found out in Indonesia and the Philippines. You know, there's been really old sites in Australia. So that work has been greatly validated. But also, whilst connecting in with that research, I did a project with an Australian team called Stephen and Evan Strong, and we wrote a book called Ancient Aliens in Australia. Now, that's previous to Forgotten Exodus, which is no longer in print. But that project connected me with a story written by a lady called Valerie Barrow. Now, that project that she had, well, this book that she put out, was called Alcheringa, When the First Ancestors Were Created. She has in there details of what seems to be a transmission from some kind of intelligence, you know, a non-human intelligence, that claims to be returning a story of human history and human evolution to the planet.
A transmission. Now,
yes, an artifact came into her possession, an artifact that's considered to be a very ancient, extremely ancient Aboriginal sacred artifact. Now, I suspect this may be some kind of alien probe, right? I'll give reasons for that in a bit, but I suspect that that's what they have. If you imagine an ancient civilization encountered an object that came from somewhere out there, well, you could see how it could become a valued sacred artifact, right? You know, you've got some strange technology, strange object that they've recovered. It seems to have the ability to use a voice-to-skull technology to transmit information, which we know in our own technology is something being developed at the moment in a lot of the sort of cutting-edge, you know, tech teams are working on.
Well, there's certainly work going on to develop technology, for example, to make speech out of your thoughts and that sort of thing. But there are people Absolutely. Looking into exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, and that's why I think if you go back 100 years or something, these things seem magical. And, you know, of course, there's that saying, any sufficiently advanced technology will seem like magic, right? So if we have an artifact that turned up thousands of years ago, what is a person going to make of it other than that this is a magical object, right? Mm. But then through the eyes of modern technology, we can revisit some of these kind of stories. And in this particular instance, that's exactly what I've done.
Two quick questions then, just to interrupt here, but I think it's important. The person that you were in contact there, how did she get hold of something that presumably in its time has been, or probably still is, sacred to that civilization?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. From what I understand, what has been explained is, I think around 100 years ago, there was a trader, and I think actually an Afghan trader with camels moving around in Australia, because this is something that used to happen, but I don't know all of the international Australian history, but apparently they used to use camels.
It was a part of Australia's past. I mean, there is a train that still runs in Australia called the GAN, which is short for Afghan, as you know.
Right, okay, so this was connected to this story. So you've got these people using these camels, and somebody had encountered a cave site out in the outback. They'd gone into this cave, found an object, this small, from what I understand, a small, looks like a stone object, about the size of a shoebox. This stone seemed to be luminous in some way, you know, glowing in some way. They took it with them, and kept it in that family. Now, later on, this other lady whose name I forgot, not the one I'm talking about who wrote the book, but someone else connected to this story, decided that this object should go back to the Aboriginal people, that clearly that, you know, their, I guess their ancestor had taken something from a cave that
quite rightly because it's part of their heritage, yes.
Right. And so this lady was trying to get it back. She became very unwell and wanted someone to look after it temporarily in case she sort of passed on. And she heard that this other person I know, Valerie, lived in a house called Alturinga. And Alturinga is a term connected with the dream time or the first time of the creator beings. And so she took it as a kind of a synchronicity that this was the right person to leave it with. Went to her house, asked her, you know, would you do this? You know, it'll be temporary. I will come back for this object. You know, it's very sacred. I've got to get it back to the Aboriginal people. And Valerie said, yes, she's a kind of holistic therapist. You know, she's into what we might call, you know, psychic and new age type topics. So she's more open to a story of a strange artifact coming from the Aboriginal people, you know. So it's not somebody who would have been like, what the heck is this? So she was willing to do that. And that's how she ended up with this artifact there. So it came to her through this strange backstory.
Okay, and why the story? I mean, I know you said it was luminous or appeared to be luminous at the time of its discovery, but how did the story evolve that this thing was different, unusual, or had powers of some kind? How did that evolve?
Shortly after it arrived in Valerie's home, she began to hear a voice in her head, and it told her that it was that this being, you know, it was a being, a star person, and its name was Alturinga, and that it wanted to relay to her this lost history. And then over a period of weeks, you know, it would communicate with her, telling her that there had been a craft had come to this planet. There had been an event where this craft had been destroyed. A few survivors had remained. And that these survivors had gone on to engineer the earliest, you know, Homo sapiens, you know, so that they were intrinsically part of our evolutionary story. It's quite a long, detailed narrative. I mean, there's a lot in there. What I took from it was, well, you know, if this is true, then there should be things in there that I, as a fairly detailed, you know, a researcher, could go into and find evidence for.
Well, there should be fingerprints and footprints somewhere in that story that you can grab hold of, I would have thought.
Exactly, and that's the position I took. And I thought, you know what, if I can validate it, then it's one of the sorts, you know, probably the story of the century or the millennia or more. If I can't, then I simply won't need to ever mention it. You know, I would just look into it, find it was nonsense, and never talk about it again.
Well, if you can stand the story up, then it will give you as many headlines, if not more, than Eric von Daniken got at the time of his research, I would have thought. Talk to me about the object, though, briefly, before we get into the story. Are you saying that it appeared, from what this woman told you, and you've taken her word on in good faith, that this thing was either a conduit of some sort or a sort of Star Trek-style communicator?
I actually would with something called a von Neumann probe, Bracewell probe, using von Neumann self-repair technology. So something that if you look into, if anyone wants to go Google those types, they'll find that NASA discussed these. The idea is that other civilizations might send out these probes with, you know, hard AI on board, sort of self-aware hard AI, that are able to repair themselves, sometimes able to self-replicate to send out more probes. That these would go out to star systems that the aliens believed might have life or might one day produce life. And so if you imagine you're an extremely advanced civilization who has that tech, it's an easy way to send out a wide net to finding, you know, other intelligences. Or if alternative, you know, somewhere's got, you know, intelligence, it's a monitoring device. So you send these out, they can sit as kind of sentinels waiting for the right moment to activate, to, you know, store information, send information back. Or, as has been theorized as well by NASA, that it's possible some of these probes could be programmed so that at the right moment in development of a species, you know, perhaps when we start using radio waves or something like that, they will detect it, activate, and make contact directly with the civilization.
Is there anything in the Aboriginal record, as far as you're aware, and I know that, you know, some of that history is verbal and passed from generation to generation, that speaks of this communication, of this thing?
Yes, and they're called Turinga stones, right? There's a couple of different nations that have them, mostly in the central north, and there's, I think, at least two or three different tribal groups have them. They are considered to be the most ancient objects, going back again to the creation of the, you know, of the human race and the creation times, this Alturinga time. They're talked about as being receptacles of consciousness that have their own, you know, awareness. and they're connected to the human creation story, and they are amongst the most sacred objects. They're only ever directly, you know, held or interacted with by the clever men, you know, these highly initiated sort of shaman, basically within the culture. So yes, the backstory from the Aboriginals actually matches extraordinarily well with what this, you know, this story tells us that, you know, this lady has got from the object, and we can see where the Aboriginal belief would have come from. You know, if they have encountered a self-aware AI or, you know, something of that sort, and it's communicated with them, you can imagine how they would see that object as being incredibly sacred and containing some kind of creator being from the Dreamtime, precisely as is claimed.
In my head right now, I can visualize my listener burning with one particular question. And I think we need to get it out of the way before we proceed. Where is this thing now, this particular one?
This one was sent on back to the actual custodians. The lady returned eventually, retrieved the object from Valerie, and had it, well, she actually passed on, but she had it sent on to go back towards Uluru and a tribal group in that area. So, assumably, they have it, as far as we know. But yeah, it was sent on back to the desert region.
Okay, but there's no deeper record of what exactly was done with it and to it beyond you think.
Once it returns to those people, no, I don't know. And I don't know if they would ever tell us, you know, where it is now or anything like that. So my interest, I'd love to, of course, have seen it. I'd love to have been able to, you know, find it. But obviously my focus has been on validating the information that's come out of that. Perhaps one day from doing that, we might be able to get in contact with someone who knows.
And while you were in Australia, did you try to find others?
Well, I think I do know of some others. Certainly, Chiringa stone is not just one. You know, there's supposed to be a few of the truly ancient Chiringa stone out there. Now, some of them may actually be held in museums, and, you know, of course, because of what happened in, you know, in Australia, there may be some in Western museums of the truly ancient ones, for all we know. But I guess it's the difficulty is there's modern ones as well. You know, because they made copies, and, you know, different groups would have, you know, what would appear to be very ancient Chiringa stones, but they wouldn't necessarily be the truly ancient ones. So we'd have some difficulty, I guess, assessing, you know, which ones are the originals and which ones are later copies. So that would definitely make it difficult.
One more very quick question just before we move on from that. Mm-hmm. What was it about its appearance or composition that suggests that it is not from here?
To be fair, Valerie did what would be considered the right thing culturally. She never opened the wrappings that it came in. It was wrapped in paper bark and then in a linen bag, and she kept it in a box in her house, because the Aboriginal people say never, you know, these things are not to be handled directly. As I say, only a shaman should do that. And to Valerie respected what she was asked of, and that was to just keep it in a box, keep it in the house until it was collected. So, you know, she honored that and never did look directly on it herself. So we can't say, we can only say what we know from that original story, that supposedly it was luminous in some way.
Okay. Well, so I guess scientists would want to be able to see this thing to validate
that, of course,
there is something unusual about it. But that doesn't detract from the story, and the story is what we're going to tell.
That's right. And also, you know, validating the information. Because, of course, even if we said that there was no artifact, and if we said, okay, somebody claimed, you know, an alien spoke to them, you know, okay, which of course happens, we hear those stories. Usually you find in these cases the stories can't be validated, or nobody has really tried, and so it's left as a, you know, anecdotal interesting story, you know, somebody's personal alien claims. So what's different in this case, whether or not people accept the artifact, is that, you know, a researcher, myself, has taken considerable time to attempt to, you know, question one of these narratives and has looked to see whether there is validating information, and has found it in multiple places.
Okay. And where would those places be?
Right. Well, there's three parts of the story that really stood out to me. So I'm not going to tackle the whole of this long narrative. And if people want to go and get a copy of this, you know, Al Chiringa, when the first ancestors were created, they can obviously see the entire transmission in there. But what I tackled is three parts: the craft, a description of the craft itself, how it was destroyed and what it was made of, and basically identifying that debris. The second part is a description of an event soon afterwards involving a bombardment, a multi-directional bombardment of asteroids on this planet. And the third one is this genetic engineering of human beings, right? So those are the three areas I tackle in the new work. So I can certainly go into those if you like.
Okay, well, why don't we take it step by step then? There are three stages. Let's start with the first one.
Right, so what's described is a very large craft, 50,000 beings, assorted kinds of beings on board, a mission involving volunteers from different star systems that collaborate out there. So if we imagine an almost Star Trek-like scenario where there seems to be a
federation
of beings. Yes, they seem to be working together on some missions. There's a mission to come to this planet, an agreement that they're going to kind of colonize. From what I understand, there's another group here that are already in place that are relatively unpleasant. There's been a negotiation that this planet is going to be handed over because apparently it was once part of this other alliance. So we get some complex exopolitics going on. The craft is described as being crystalline and having been grown rather than built. It's been grown in a matrix. It is then imbued with an artificial intelligence. So we have a silica crystal, largely silica crystal craft with an AI that exists throughout the frame. Now, there's a reason why this is particularly important, because at first one might think, well, sounds kind of, you know, new agey or woo or something, you know, crystals and if you go and look at where, you know, where our leading, you know, cutting edge scientists are talking about with where they think aliens will be, we find, you know, some advanced alien life forms.
Well, they talk a lot about our harmonization with robotics, and that's all silicon chips.
Absolutely. And you find they say that they expect some of these beings to live in vast silica networks, right? And so when you are looking at this description of this craft as this vast silica network, where instead of having a computer on board the ship is the computer, you have an aha moment and think, well, that's extraordinarily brilliant, because you now have processing power, you know, extends throughout the entire craft. You have this unbelievably, you know, advanced computer AI on board who's running the ship and is the ship. And then there's these 50,000 beings that are obviously been accompanying it as it comes here. The craft is then described as having been fired on in orbit around Earth. This is a long time ago. I should clarify here. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years ago. They suggest towards 900,000, but a more precise date in a moment, that this craft is fired on. There's a description of it having come apart, but also melted, and parts of this melted debris rain down all across, you know, a vast area of the planet, right? So I took that as a starting point of something that we could perhaps identify in the geological record.
All right, so the craft, yeah, according to this account, was fired mm-hmm. upon by the ones who you said were not very nice, who were already here.
Yes, correct, yes. And so they destroyed the craft. So there's only a few survivors, a few saucer craft come down, they land, but the actual mothership is in bits. You know, we're having a rain of debris coming down from this, what I believe to be about a 1 kilometer diameter craft. So we're talking about, you know, a large mothership that had, you know, holds 50,000. So it's not small by any stretch. This thing is raining down, you know, it's blown to bits. I'm looking in the geological records because I'm thinking, well, okay, do we have something that might mesh with the idea of melted silica, you know, raining down across a large part of the planet? You know, that could potentially remain, because silica really can remain in place for millions of years. Unlike metal craft, you know, if we have a metal saucer, it's very unlikely that hundreds of thousands of years later you're going to be able to identify that. But silica is fairly unique in that, you know, it's very stable, right?
Well, it's so, obviously with the relation to glass, if you have something that is glass or, you know, made of glass, then the chances are that fragments of it may well survive for many, many, many thousands of years.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very, very, very durable. So it was hope there. So, you know, so I had a look in the records and found that yes, there actually is this a scenario matching this, that there's a 100 year long mystery in science, one that I hadn't heard of, despite the fact, you know, I'm very interested in ancient mysteries. The mystery is basically revolves around a material called australite tektites. And australite tektites, as the name may infer, they are largely found across Australia. But in fact, they stretch all the way from Antarctica to, I think, southern China. There's these small pieces of debris, right? They are made of about 75% silica from melted quartz, right? They have a whole lot of other elements in there as well, aluminium and other stuff. But obviously, the bulk of it is silica. They have a unique shape. At least the parts found in southern Australia do. They have a button shape. And then, of course, this huge area of debris suggests something anomalous, because we've got almost a picture in their mind, you know, a debris field that stretches basically all the way, you know, pretty much, you know, from Antarctica up into China. I mean, that's, it's a vast area, isn't it?
And if you look at these things, of course, we know that there are objects that are created by nature quite naturally that can look as if they've been manufactured, but these look as if they have been. I mean, they're very shiny, they're very perfectly formed, they're a perfect round shape, and you wonder to yourself, although I'm sure it can happen, and I know that in some spheres these things do happen, how can something be so perfectly round?
Yes, they do stand out, and that's why I think that they were taken as somehow important by even the Aboriginal people. You know, they used to call them, I think, eyes because of this round shape that they have on them. And they considered them to be power objects. You know, they would keep them along with their crystals. They would keep these pieces as well from this material.
And they have been a mystery, and they have been researched a lot. I checked them out before we did this conversation. A lot of geologists believe that they are perfectly natural, but they are unusual.
I will tell you why there's a problem, why it's been a 100-year mystery. Because if it was one, you know, easily solved, there wouldn't still be an ongoing mystery with this, right? Because, you've had chemists, geologists, you know, NASA scientists, everybody has been throwing things at this, you're trying to understand the entire backstory, right? And it remains in a flux because they cannot come to a final agreement. And the reason for this is because, firstly, it was assumed that this must come from an impact, right? So they thought, well, let's look for a crater, because if it's dated at 780,000 years, right? And in terms of large impacts, that's very young. So you'd expect to find the obvious crater, and then you'd be able to, you know, pretty much club kind of halfway clear of the mystery. You know, then you investigate the crater, find out what happened. But what they found instead is that you can trace the largest chunks up to an area in Laos called Muang Nong. And there you've got pieces about 20 kilo pieces, right? So a 20 kilo piece doesn't go far, right? So you know that if there's an impact site, it's there, yeah? What they found is there's no crater. So, and also, of course, if you have an impact that throws material out, the chances of throwing material all the way from Laos down to Antarctica is really unlikely. I mean, there's that kind of, you know, thing is unseen in the record, put it that way.
Could they not have been something that approached us, came to us from space, like an asteroid or meteorite, something like that, that broke up and spun round in a way that formed these perfect objects?
No, and there's a couple of reasons why. When the NASA scientists are looking at this, what they realized is that, yes, it has to be something that came from space, and the reason we see the shapes that we do on the button ones is, again, to do with formation in space. Because what happened is, they say, an object, and this is the bit that really should bring people to question this, is an object had to have been in orbit around our planet, like another little moon, right? And that this object exploded for some unknown reason, right? And that the material it was made of became liquid. And so you have a quartz-type material that is liquefied in an intense heat event, and the liquid then forms spherical droplets, as it does in a vacuum, right? So you end up with these perfect spheres. The spheres, it's then described that these continue to move in a sort of orbital path, that they're almost horizontal with the Earth's plane, and that's what allowed slow heating and melting to form these button shapes. And so they've thrown other experiments at it, and they said this is the only scenario that explains the material, right? So you have an orbiting object, explodes, melts, produces these spheres. They then have secondary melting, so they turn from a sphere into these button shapes as they come down, right? And that's what explains the tectite button part of the debris field. Then as you move further up towards northern Australia, you have some different types, these dumbbells and other types. Now, these result, it seems, I'm referring to this as a US geologist who's put a long time into his own research of this material, thinks that we had some chunks of material from whatever this was that have broken through the atmosphere, and that those have then gone on to form aerial bursts, of extremely high power aerial bursts, where these larger chunks have blown apart, and then they've produced these other types, these dumbbell stuff, where they only have primary melting, no secondary melting. So the buttons are only in a limited part of the debris field. And if you imagine that, so you have an object that's coming down in a decaying orbit, it's been blown apart. The first wave of debris comes through from space. And of course, as the chunks now breaking the atmosphere, you no longer have that type. You have the other type where these explosions are happening as larger chunks make their way down. And the remnants of the debris, the angle of descent basically finishes in sort of Laos and surrounding areas. And that's where you get these big chunks. Okay. So the observed finds mesh only with a event that has a large silica object exploding up in space.
Okay, so if there was a crash of this kind, were there survivors from the crash?
Yes, and it's described as there being small saucer craft that make their way down. Some are blown out of the sky, but there are a few that make their way down, and that these land at a place called Gosford in New South Wales. There's a description in there where Valerie and two friends, a friend and an Aboriginal elder, a healer who was very well known in his day, called Jerry, who's passed on now, but he was highly respected, used to travel to the US, doing healings there and whatnot, that he ended up connected to the story. He heard about a house being called Algeringa. He was with a friend of hers, said, I want to go there. I want to go meet this person who lives in this house. I've got a feeling I should meet them. Goes there and ends up in there having a chat with her. And she sort of has a feeling that he knows that she has the artifact. And so she sort of says to him, look, it's just in a box in the other room. And he says, it's men's business. So he knows somehow on some level, he senses what she has there. He knows that these artifacts are only for elders, male elders. There's a tradition it would just be the clever men. So he somehow knows. And they have a conversation and he says, look, I think you need to go to a place called Gosford with me. And so they take a trip down there. And whilst there, they have what I suppose we would call a time slip. I know you're most certainly, I imagine, familiar with a few of these stories where people
more than
suddenly find they're in another time.
Fascinating yes. Stories, very rare, but remarkable when they happen, if they do.
Yes. And in this one, it's particularly remarkable because the time slip involves them suddenly finding that they're now looking down at the beach they call Broken Bay, and they're looking down and they can see a saucer craft crashed in the water. There's another one above hovering, picking up survivors out of the water. There seems to be dolphins pushing beings in to the coast. There's assortment of beings on the beach, very strange, clearly not human. And these three people realize that they themselves now do not look like human beings. They look at each other. They can see they're tall and skinny with elongated heads and, quite clearly are now in non-human bodies.
So they thought they were experiencing this through the eyes of creatures.
Yes. So they actually had an event. When they arrive at Gosford, they have a time slip and start to see some of what happened themselves. That is part of then more of the information coming through, because if they see some of it, they also sense information. Jerry realizes that he was one of the pilots in another life, that he was one of the pilots of one of these crafts. He says to them that throughout his life, he's had a dream where he's on a large white craft. He said there's alarms going and he's rushing to get his family to a smaller craft, and that he's had this dream going throughout his life. And that now he says, I understand why. I can see now what it was all about, and that I was a pilot on one of these craft that came down. In fact, the pilot of the crashed craft, and he remembers dying in the water. So then after this, she is told by the voice of this artifact that you were involved in this story in another life, and that there's other people on this planet today that are reincarnated from this story, and you're going to meet a lot of these people, and they're going to further validate everything I've told you.
So are we saying that in some way, because he'd been having these dreams and this recurring experience, that this story and this civilization were somehow locked within his makeup, his DNA?
Yes, and it seems something that he had no problem with. I think Aboriginal nations people perhaps are, of course, more open to strange events and strange things than the average Westerner. So he had no problem with the fact that he'd been dreaming a story of an alien visitation, and that within the cultural narratives of many Aboriginal tribes, there is a story of visitors connected with the Pleiades that are involved in the creation of mankind, right? So this is not, for them, this is not far out. This is something that links in with these creator spirits that had a role in, forming humans and other animals and things on this planet.
So this story that unfolded at Gosford, what of the people, or I call them people, what of the race of aliens that shot down the craft in the first place? Was there some kind of battle going on there?
Yeah, there seems to be a history. Let's say that there's been at some point, a hot war, which has become more of a cold war, where they negotiate, and now it's a bit different. But from what I can understand, it sounds like there was a hot war in the very distant past. Remember, we're dealing hundreds of thousands of years ago. And I'll put a precise date on it, of course, 780,000 years ago, because we have the dating of the material. And I also have dating of the other two parts of this story. So I know that we're talking about 780,000 years ago. At this point, this hot war has already become cool, you know, so they can negotiate. However, as we can tell by the shooting down of the craft, there's sparks left in this Cold War. And so these other beings are described as being sort of humanoid, reptilian-looking beings, right? Which is, I'm sure, is a theme most people have heard of, if from nowhere else, but from the famous works of David Icke. But, of course, this is unconnected from his writings. You know, this is coming from another source. Again, Aboriginal tales tell of a reptilian-type being, and sometimes put into the creation stories that they have a role in creating humans as well, which is interesting because that's reflected in this narrative as well, that they do mention that these reptilians have had a hand in creating the very earliest hominins on this planet. Not Homo sapiens, but the hominins that, you know, give us some of their DNA, that those two are engineered.
Okay. I mean, that's a big story. So what became of the survivors, those who were involved in that recovery operation on that beach and elsewhere? You know, where did they go and what did they do?
Well, they realized that they couldn't survive long term here. That's the first thing, because without the mothership, without the technology on board, what they had planned, and again, this makes some sense, for, you know, is that they couldn't directly just come and land here and live here, you know, because obviously every planet is different. They didn't have, you know, our tolerances to the sun, to the bacteria in the water, to, you know, to the food that existed here. You know, there's a lot of the problems you can imagine if we crashed on an alien planet. In a real world, not where in a sci-fi film where somehow we just are okay. You know, they are facing these problems and they're dying. Some of them are dying off from these different problems.
And they even though their mother race had such amazing technology, they didn't try and rescue them.
Yes. I'll tell you why. Because what they would do is they use their own genetic engineering technologies to modify themselves to be able to live on different planets. Right. Mm-hmm. I suspect that's something that humans will go on to do. And in fact, they were at the beginning of that, right, with the CRISPR technologies and this gene editing, that you can change yourself so that you can inhabit different worlds.
So they decided we're not going to stay here. We're not going to go back home. We're going to stay here and integrate with the people.
Well, they've lost their tech. They've lost the motherships. They can't leave. They've only have these small scout craft, right, which aren't designed for this journey back. But what they can do, they have enough technology left that they can begin some modification of a resident hominin that can already live here, a sort of upgrade, which will form part of a plan B to change this planet and bring it back to their direction, away from these other beings. So they realize that this is something they can do, and putting a part of themselves into these beings, they decide that, yeah, they will use what's left of their tech on board these smaller craft to begin modifying embryos and creating a kind of a hybrid. They themselves know that, yeah, they can't do what they would have done, modifying themselves in adequate time. You know, that's not going to work. It was a long-term plan. You know, it would have had the ship in the orbit. They would have been going up and down, continuing their gene modification of themselves. You know, this was plan A. Plan A is gone with the mothership. So plan B is the, you know, the fallback. The other thing they can do, and the reason why this is also self-interest, it's not just, you know, we're upgrading humanity, you know, for humans' best interests, right? This is a sort of self-interested, because they also say they have the ability to direct their incarnations. So in the same way that Tibetan High Lamas say they can, that when they pass on, they can choose to go into the next body they want. And in this case, they are planning to incarnate into the first generations of hominins that they have modified. So you, if you imagine, it's along the lines of creating a biological spacesuit that they, their consciousness can leave those injured or dying bodies and enter into one of these created, you know, biological spacesuits, which are the earliest Homo sapiens, a very archaic form of our sort of subspecies. So this is the underlying plan. Now, there's a reason to show that this is true, because again, at the moment, I fully understand people, well, okay, it all sounds very speculative, you know, what supports this? But I would say as well, we jumped over one thing. I want to add in here as well that whilst they're on the ground, a second mission is launched, and there's another group that arrives. Okay, about this is described as being 5 years after the shooting down of the mothership, and this is a less friendly mission, with a group of beings that has arrived to enforce the original agreement with this subterranean race that's here. And they give a warning. They say, you know, leave the planet. You know, that was the agreement. If you don't, we're going to bombard your underground bases. Now, this, I would think, you know, by the way they describe it, it would have been quite a mega event, because they say that, you know, what we do is we don't just fire laser beams down or something, you know, in the way that we might expect in a sci-fi film. So what they do is they pull asteroids out of orbit. They bring them to the target planets, and they say, look, we can crack open a planet. This is how big we can pull in asteroids and comets and things. We can pull them in like with tractor beam type technologies that we see in Star Trek, that kind of thing, something that, you know, an energy weapon that drags these things behind them. And then they just pull them in and launch them down. They say, literally, yeah, can kill a planet. They're not intending to kill the planet, right? What they want to do is get rid of this other group. Most of these beings leave. It's described that they jump through a kind of a stargate, some sort of gateway, going back to Orion. Now, that's where they say these beings are going to. Some don't go, and they launch this bombardment, right, with asteroids hitting from all sides, yep, and basically wipe out.
So you're saying this other group who want the group who crashed away from here and to take away their plan for this place, they're slingshotting material from space at Earth. Is that right?
Not them, sorry. No, these are other members of this alliance. They've arrived five years later.
Yes, the ones who arrived 5 years later want those who'd arrived here off the planet, yeah?
No, they want the original group, the underground group that blew up the ship.
I've got you. So they launch a final bid to get rid of them. Sorry, yep, got it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So this is a slightly more militaristic faction of this alliance. And so they say, look, get off. They make contact with the survivors. They offer the survivors the chance to leave the planet. The survivors say, no, we're going to continue with plan B, which is modifying these humans. And most of us have died anyway. Look, we're going to stick with it. We're going to finish off what we're doing. Obviously, don't, you know, protect our areas. Don't kill us, you know, but they don't want to leave. So instead, they say, you know, obviously, get on with the other mission, which is to get rid of these beings. So that's their choice. They do have the opportunity to have left with these militaristic, you know, craft. However, that doesn't happen. So then there is a bombardment. Now, I was thinking to myself, look, if there was a multi-directional asteroid bombardment of our planet, you know, within the last million years, say, that's going to leave some scars. You know, there's going to be some sort of evidence of that. And I was kind of surprised that I hadn't heard of it. I thought, well, if I haven't heard of it and it was on such a scale, maybe it's because it simply didn't happen, you know, that this is something that either that can't be validated or there's no evidence or it didn't happen, right? So I was having a look, you know, looking through the geological records, you know, looking for any papers, you know, is there anything that would validate this extreme event, you know? Because as far as I recall from science, you know, the last time this planet was really hitting multi-directional asteroid bombardments, of course, was in the formation of the solar system when there was the chaos of, you know, of objects flying all around, hitting planets. And, you know, after that, it's become more stable and it's more occasional that a large asteroid will hit Earth. You know, it's a fairly, although regular, it's interspersed by vast periods of time, right? So it would be quite extraordinary to have lots of them pummel Earth at once, right? Especially in more recent times. And so there was actually nothing in the papers, but incredibly, I found an article that came out in, I think it's 2015. It was in the UK press and also somewhere else, I think in the US press, but it's a German archaeological team had been, I don't know why they'd end up they were looking for something like this, but they stumbled on the evidence for a multi-directional bombardment of our planet, and the dating on it, they said around 780,000 years ago, right? So we've got now the material dated from this strange orbiting crystal object, right? 780,000 years old. Now a multi-directional asteroid bombardment, and they said there's impact sites are in Mexico, in Australia, in, I think, also in Africa, one down in Tasmania, but there's a number of them, and they think that they seem to be different asteroids, you know, different composition. So we're not even talking about a swarm where something breaks up, you know, causes a swarm, but actually different objects coming from different sides of the planet hitting at the same time, right? Which is bizarre. And having already read this in an account that says it's coming, you know, from an entity that knows our history, and keep in mind here that the book from which I am working, if you like, it's published in 2002 from a story of events in 1995. So there is no way the author can know about this as a discovery in 2015. Yeah. And so we have this hand in glove fit that, yes, there was this pummeling, mysterious bombardment that caused, it said, all sorts of tsunamis, earthquakes, you know, a mega event right bang on the moment that it should be if it was real from this account. So that's strike two for the major events in this narrative.
Okay, well, I mean, it's a hell of a story. So what becomes of the survivors who decide we're staying, we are going to go ahead with our plan. We've got rid of the bad guys, and we're going to meld with the early human beings, if we want to call them that, who are here. What becomes of them, and what do they do?
Yep, so they carry on with this project, and they begin to incarnate into the created hominins. And so technically, I would say they are still here, because there's no reason to think that they're not. Because if this is their long-term plan, and they are able to incarnate into humans, you know, in the longer term, I believe they're still here. At that time, yes, they enter, you know, they're dying off, and they're entering into these bodies. They create more than one. You know, if you imagine a project where initially you're working on, obviously, like, say, a human project, we're working on engineering a new species or changing a species, you're going to end up with some dodgy results. You know, you're going to end up with some different results. And so it doesn't always work out. But they create some that don't survive, but they go on to create these early humans, some of which are successful, and they would begin to break away into different groups. And if you think, if you have an organized test group, so you'd have group A can mate with group B or not with C, and et cetera. It's kind of done like that. And the funny thing is that until about, well, until about 3 years ago, it was thought that the ancestors of, you know, modern humans, if you go back to the really beginning of what we call Homo sapiens, and also Neanderthals, that these two species were supposed to have separated around about 400,000 years ago or so, right? And that they had shared a common ancestor that perhaps about 500,000 years ago, something like that. It was around in that period, okay? There was obviously a bit of uncertainty in these kind of datings of like divergence events in evolution. But just in the last couple of years, there's been a number of finds, a number of changes in this story. And in fact, in just this last week, there's been another article coming out saying that what they think now is that Homo sapiens, look, for me, Homo sapiens, I would put them as the main species. And we have subspecies, Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, Homo sapiens, you know, modernus, if you like, Homo sapiens Denisova. But these groups, these subspecies, can all interbreed. Like that's been well shown now. And there's a number of scientists moving towards the position of they're all within the Homo sapiens species with subspecies. And I think that's going to be shown to be absolutely accurate, because we can no longer say they are separate, right? Because we have their DNA. They were mating with each other. And they've also found that the dating for the split seems to go back to around about, I think the first was they changed it to 500 to 750. And now in the last week, there's an article come out saying they think it was close to 800,000 years ago, right? So bear in mind, my dates have been out there since the Forgotten Exodus, but I've been saying that this happened about 780,000 years ago. And I've got that obviously time stamped in print in my work. And now we're seeing the headlines are coming out saying that we think that these groups like Neanderthals and Denisovans and modern humans go back to a split close to 800,000 years ago. Now that's bang on what I would predict, because if you imagine the experiment is producing different hominin lines, right? And suddenly at that period, around 800,000 years ago, suddenly instead of having just a couple of different groups out there like Erectus, you know, we have suddenly an explosion of changes that with the beginnings of Neanderthals, Denisovans, us, and other what they call ghost populations of large-brained hominins that our ancestors have interbred with. There seems to be a lot of them, right, just appear out of nowhere and just start, you know, going on to modify, you know, to evolve to become larger brained, right, at a very rapid rate. And that this, if you look at a brain growth chart, you'll also see that's radical in the growth of the brain. Mm. So we have now hand in glove mesh, and that the dating on this is extraordinarily close to 780,000 years ago for the origins of all of these large brained humans. So that was the third part, and if you like, the most important part of this validation, because even if the other two hadn't panned out, the true interest here, of course, is our own origins, you know, and where we've come from, the mystery, you know, of the large-brained Homo sapiens, right, and what happened to produce us. So we have all three, though, which has been the incredible thing, is that all three areas I wanted to look at and wanted to see if I could validate have been validated, and not just the date, but I found specific signatures in the human genome that point to engineering.
Now, okay, what signatures, that was the next thing I was going to ask. You know, where are the signs within us today that this happened?
Absolutely. One of the biggest ones is, in fact, I would say this is the marker for the Homo sapiens species, right, is the fusion of chromosome 2. Now, we are unique, as far as we know, in the primate family, in that we have, you know, we've had a fusion of two, an end-to-end fusion on two chromosomes that's produced our chromosome 2, okay? So rather than being a 48-chromosome hominin, we are 46. Now, sometimes in nature, you get natural chromosome fusions, right? They can happen. They're nearly always deleterious, you know, that there'll be some kind of health problems associated with that, right? There's an exception, I think, in horses, wild horses and tame horses. But again, that involves us, right? Taming horses and having them living distinct from the other group, right? But so in that case, as far as I know, there's not a health problem. But within our species, normally that doesn't happen. And what you'd have is interbreeding and later where these, you know, so it never becomes widespread because these sort of problems or changes are then swallowed into the background masses, right, of the what you'd call the normal functional genome. So these stay as occasional blips. What we had instead when this arose in our species is a total replacement, right? We went from having these 48 chromosomes everywhere to having it nowhere. And all humans today, except those with these issues, if you like, problems, will have 46 chromosomes. Now, looking closer at that fusion, you find that it fuses on an active gene. This is considered something that doesn't naturally happen. And this active gene relates to this three different systems. I think the reproductive system, the brain, and the immune system, areas you'd want to get at if you were going to modify a human. The experts who've looked into this topic have sort of said as well that to explain how it would have become so widespread, firstly, you'd have to have an emergence of this change in a fairly small group, an isolated group. Now, again, that's very close to what you'd have as a test group, right? In an experiment in Australia, an isolated continent, that you've got a small test group. So they say you'd get a widespread distribution because you've got a small, fairly insular population, right? Which isn't then mixing with a second group that doesn't have the mutation. So that's an ideal way. The second thing they'd expect is it would have to be something that gives extraordinary evolutionary benefits for it to then become a persistent, you know, anomaly and to actually be retained. So we know that whatever that change was, it gave incredible benefits and it must have occurred in a small isolated population. That's some key points of that change. Now, that's not on its own. It's not just the chromosome fusion, but I'd say that's the clearest marker for what was going on. Surrounding that, we also have some really strange genes that emerge. We have one of them is to do with the neocortex, the folds in the brain, which gives us some of our incredible processing power, because obviously gives more surface area to the brain having folds than having a smooth brain. Now, there's a gene in there that they describe as having, well, one of them describe as having emerged out of the non-coding DNA, which was once called junk, fully formed. They actually put it in, they say, we don't know, it just appears out of this sort of junk DNA. And then there's another one which they say appears to be a short segment from a longer gene that looks almost like it's been, you know, taken out, cut, snipped, copied, and put back in. And that's exactly what we're doing with CRISPR technologies, right? So when you get academics using these kind of terms, you know, appearing out of nowhere, clipped and put back in, you know, you can sort of see in the literature itself that they're like, what the heck is going on here?
So you're saying that the kind of editing that I've done interviews about involving that CRISPR technology that you're talking about, that we're experimenting with now, we're talking about now, that's already happened?
Absolutely. It's already happened, and that there's clear signatures in there which are known of, and which are, at this point, I think that some of them are just being left as, we don't know. But you can imagine, because you know how conservative science is, that it'd be a very brave academic, wouldn't it, who'd say, well, this looks like ancient CRISPR technologies. That's a career ender for your, you know,
well,
for your
I was just going to say to you, Bruce, that the only way to validate this, it seems to me, other than theorizing, which you've done, and you've built a very comprehensive story here that makes very interesting listening, but the only way to really validate it is if the race from whom we are partly descended, you think, is still there, which a lot of people say it is, then it needs to come here and prove the story, doesn't it? We need to be in contact with them, if we're not already, and then we can validate this story, and then we can all come together in perfect harmony. Or can we?
To some degree, yes. But then again, I think that there's elements here that could be validated by our academics, right? Because not only do we have these, there's another, I don't know how much time I have, but I'll just quickly answer another area of this, which is really important, which should have already validated this story in a way, because these are not unknown findings. You know, like I'm putting them together, but these, of course, are, you know, coming from academics, right? There's another area. There's some SETI scientists, or the post-SETI detection group, who say that one of the ways we might find, you know, evidence of an alien race is we might find that they came here in the distant past, modified some elements of the, you know, DNA, and they would have had to have modified the parts that are highly conserved. And that means the areas that are really important, hardly ever change, you know, and that usually these are in the non-coding areas of the genome. They say, now, if they modified something in there, it could persist almost indefinitely for millions of years, right? And that we would be able to go in and see these anomalies, okay? Now, in another branch of science, down in the with these evolutionary genetics, you know, experts, they have found areas of the human genome called human accelerated regions, right? This is fairly new. This is quite cutting edge. And in these areas, there are short chunks of DNA which have been extraordinarily changed in a very short period. Right? This is why they call them human accelerated regions, because they have accelerated evolution and they're only in humans. And now I'll give you one example, just to give how radical these are. There is a stretch of 118 DNA letters, right? Which if you look at a chicken, a chimpanzee, and a human, right, you can see the difference. You get a chicken and a chimpanzee have a three letter difference. So this shows that they're so highly conserved that in 300 million years, only three natural changes occurred, right, in that vast period. Now, take chimpanzees and humans, who are supposed to be separate by just 5 million years. They expected no changes between those two, that they'd be the same. Instead, they found an 18-letter difference. The conclusion given by the academic team involved was, you know, crunching the numbers, and in fact, one of them's a biostatistician, she writes the programs that give us these numbers, she came to the conclusion that there was a 0% chance of this by any known evolutionary means. And this is just one of these. They found now hundreds of these HARs, and this is precisely what the post-detection team at SETI have said we should look for. Radical, anomalous changes in highly conserved regions of non-coding DNA. Now, what I don't understand is, why am I having to put that together and not the people who are telling us that's what we should look for?
Well,
because it's very bizarre.
That is a very hard question for me to answer. Some of my listeners who are scientists might want to take issue with them, and I know you don't mind receiving emails from people, so
maybe we can
get some contact details at the back end of this. But what that would suggest, and I have heard about the thing you've just talked about, is that we've been hot-rodded, we've been modified.
Yep. Yep. And it's very clear. I mean, even without all of that other backstory, and people say, well, that's too strange, I can't deal with that. But an academic should be able to deal with the very thing that we've been told that the post-detection team should be looking for. Now, if you just take out all the rest of what I've said then, just say, we've got the signature that they've said we should look for, then that is the bit that I would like academics to focus on, because that won't ruin their careers, because it's already officially out there. Is that's what we might expect if there'd ever been, you know, a civilization passing through here for whatever reason, which is not considered, you know, out there. You know, again, that's been posited by the leading luminaries in these fields. Mm. So I'm a bit baffled why it's getting left to someone like me to do that.
Well, if I came into this world and I didn't know my father, I think there would be an innate drive within me, as happens with so many people, to find that person, or my mother. You know, I would have to find them. Similarly, it would seem to me then, based on what you're saying, there needs to be, and perhaps there is already, a drive to find those who spawned us in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder whether maybe the people you need to be making contact with, apart from the orthodox scientists about this, are people who are doing that kind of thing, trying to contact those who you claim we came from.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I do reach out to people. I will say I'm continually reaching out to people, to scientists and other researchers. The engagement from the other side is low, you know, that I will perhaps get the odd academic who will talk to me. And obviously, I don't go straight in with, hey, here's a super strange, you know, but making a contact saying, you know, there's this area of genetics or there's this issue that I'd like you to look at. It's hard. I understand that, firstly, that a lot of people are very busy. I'm not a fellow academic, so they're going to look straight away as, you know, well, you know, I've got to talk to Dr. So-and-so next week, and who's this guy? So I have obviously a lot of barriers, but I am slowly making progress with connecting with some relevant people in the background.
But I guess some of them would say that you've put two and two together and made 25.
Well, then I would say put it back to them. Well, please offer an explanation other than this one for these human accelerated regions. You know, because if they're leading academics are saying, we have nothing, right? We have zero. Then in science, you're supposed to accept the strongest hypothesis, right? So if this is the only hypothesis, right, that explains what we observe, isn't that the strongest one, Howard?
I think it's a hypothesis that people might have laughed at 25 or 30 years ago. I think a lot of people hearing this now in 2019, maybe they'll sit down, have a cup of coffee and have a good old think about it and consider the prospect that maybe this is what happened.
Well, look at Chandra Wickramasinghe, right? You know, he's been going for, what, decades on the panspermia issue, right, as to whether or not life was seeded here. Serious academic. I mean, and, you know, look, he has battled all the way up, you know, to get to the position he's at.
So, well, somebody even has to think out of the box. That's the fact. There's no doubt about that. Otherwise, we never make any progress. It is an extraordinary story. You know that there will be a lot of people who will say it is just implausible, but that shouldn't stop you from doing the research that you're doing, in my view.
No, and I hope that it would at least have some academics quietly looking at it, even if they don't want to come straight out and say, hey, I'm going to look at this. But we need an equivalent to Chandra Wickramasinghe, but someone who's willing to look at not just panspermia and the origins of life on the planet, but these sort of modifications. You know, is this in some way artificial? You know, could it be explained by any other natural means? You know, you need someone like him to step in and be able to look at this, you know, with their full knowledge of DNA and their full knowledge of evolutionary processes, and to check it, because that's how science is supposed to work, isn't it? You know, debunk me, right?
Right. Have you had any reaction from the Aboriginal community and from leaders? Have any of them, you know, I mean, I don't know what they might say, but one thought might be that if anybody's going to tell what you are saying is their story, they should be telling it, not you.
Well, I haven't had much reaction for this work, only for the previous one, in which I argue, obviously, that Australia was central to the emergence of Homo sapiens and that that's where the story happened. I've had quite a lot of support for that because that matches very well with their own story, which is that, you know, humans originated in Australia, that they've always been there, they've always been on their land, and that all other people come from them, right? So you can imagine, obviously, there's a lot of people there who have thought, well, Christ, there's this researcher who's actually found white man's science evidence that supports our story, which is, you know, what they'd kind of expected to eventually happen. So I've had some support for that. The new material, I haven't heard much really in from a little bit, but nothing negative. I've not been attacked. I've not had that thing of saying, you're trying to tell our story. I mean, I guess I've been careful not to say, you know, this is what Aboriginal people think of it or anything like, you know, so I've tried to avoid a kind of a clash in that way and try to look at, this is what I've found. I am aware, though, from at least a couple of people, that this story is considered to be fairly close to at least legends in their own nations, because there's so many nations there, but with this, a visitation of spirit beings from the Pleiades modifying humans. So I'm probably in line with some of the stories, but not all of them, because there's many different.
I think you're onto something fascinating. It isn't for me, it's above my pay grade to say whether this is completely true, partly true, or not true at all. But I think it's worth putting it out there, Bruce. What are you going to do next now?
There's a follow-up book coming on this same topic. The initial book, Hybrid Humans, is fairly short. It's focused very much in on, it's a zoom in on my analysis of, you know, Valerie's book. The follow-up one is a bit broader. It tackles this from the bigger picture, you know, and also going into some of what's happening now in the US military revelations, but and also bring out more of the science that I found on the engineering. Now, that should be out in April 2020. It's with a US publisher, and at the moment, it's got a foreword from someone you mentioned earlier in the interview, actually, which is Eric von Daniken. So obviously, I've impressed some people.
Well, I'm very, very pleased about that. That's excellent news. I think we need to be doing an interview about that around about Christmas. How about you?
That sounds good to me. Yep. So as soon as they've confirmed they've got the the book scheduled for a date and all that, we can come back on that. So yes, I think that the next book is the one that will make the waves. This one's probably not reached enough people.
All right. Well, maybe after this, it'll reach a few more. The book is called Hybrid Humans. How do people get hold of it?
They can go to Amazon. They'll find it on Amazon. And also, of course, Forgotten Exodus on there if they fancy looking at my earlier book as well, which does tie in. And my website's brucefenton.info. There's also hybridhumans.net. So, and they can check out ancientnews.net as well, where I write articles about human evolution.
Bruce, next time we talk, you'll probably be in Gloucestershire. Nice to speak with you again.
Yes. Thank you very much, Howard. Really appreciate it.
And the man you've been hearing is Bruce Fenton. The book is Daniela Fenton on the cover. That's his partner, and it's called Hybrid Humans, as they say, available now. And another book coming out around about the beginning of next year. So we'll talk with Bruce Fenton later in the year, all being well. A fascinating story. I know that you will have your opinions on that, and I'm very pleased that you let me or him know them. If you want to let me know them, you can go to my website, theunexplained.tv, and send me a message. Follow the link from there, and I'll get it. If you want to make a donation to the show, that will be gratefully received also at the website, theunexplained.tv. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.